So just a few words of introduction that are not related to my lecture. This is actually, I was reminded, the Chai anniversary this year of my own graduation from Yeshiva College. And it's really, when you're in a place, sometimes you don't appreciate how special it is. And when you leave, sometimes you just reminisce, sometimes you joke, but as the years go by, or maybe as your own children start to get close to college age, I have a son who's a senior in high school in Israel, you begin to realize how much a place influenced your own development and personality and spirituality and intellectual evolution. And I feel very privileged to have attended Yeshiva University, and I'm a little jealous of you guys. I don't know if you're all from YU, some of you may be from other institutions, but I think that college is and grad school is and learning is such a wonderful period of life, and I feel very blessed that I teach in college. That's what I do until now. I'm still in college, but even if you don't do that the rest of your life, make the most of it, because it's really wonderful, and I thank you all for making the effort to be here. I want to particularly recognize, Ezra mentioned Menachem Butler, and Menachem's also a good friend of mine. He knows a lot of people. Again, there are lots of people in YU who are doing wonderful things now. You wouldn't believe it if you just look around the room at your friends, here, and outside in the Beit Midrash, in the classrooms, some of them, a lot of them are going to end up doing amazing things for many years to come, and it's a privilege to be a part of that group. On a personal level, my mom, Mrs. Sandy Ferziger, is here, and, that's wonderful. And a new addition to our family, my father passed away 9 years ago, and Baruch Hashem, my mother is getting married on Hanukkah to Dr. Fred Gottlieb. And we're thrilled. We've only known him for about 45 years, but you know, some things take a little gestation, but thank God. And finally, this talk is entitled Brother or Other, and I want to reassure my brother Jonathan, who's here from Israel as well, that you are my brother and not my other. And I love you and thank you for being here as well. Okay, so let's start in an old Jewish tradition with a lousy joke. Okay? And not only is a lousy joke, because it's a lousy joke and it's a pathetic joke, but you all know it already. So this is about familiarity breeding discontent. Okay, but I'm just going to tell you because, I don't know, it's a good opener. So, there's this, I call him the Jewish Robinson Crusoe, right? That Nebuch guy who gets stuck on a desert island, and he's got nothing to do with his time, but he's a good strong yid, right? So, he becomes a bonel, a builder. And finally, after 20 years, someone comes and figures out that he's there with his, what, a GPS watch or whatever it is, and they arrive, and of course, not only do they find him, but they find the great edifices that he has constructed. They find, in fact, how many buildings?
Three buildings.
Three buildings. I guess maybe it was a known joke, but, you know, generational thing. So, like with my students. I used to quote the Rolling Stones and the Who, and I'd start a sentence and they would end them, and now they just say, Who? You know, it's very embarrassing, but I'm getting old. So, anyway, they look around and they say, what's the story here? She says, oh, that building over there, that's the house. So, that's my big center, that's my shul. Beautiful. And what about that beautiful building over there? That shul? I wouldn't step foot in that shul. Good. Don't laugh, because it's a pathetic dumb joke, but it's very helpful to me. Okay, this is, you know, of course everyone loves to tell that joke and see how terrible Jews are. There's not, it's not even Plato's communitas. It's one person, and already we have here this division, this inability to come to some sort of unifying, religious life, so he's gotta build that machlokas shul. Now, I have heard this joke a million times, but at some point, I encountered this idea called the sociology of deviance. And all of a sudden, my whole perception of that joke began to change. And I want to share that with you. The sociology of deviance, which is a field which was really pioneered by someone, a French Jew by the name of Durkheim, and was developed further throughout the 20th century. He began in the turn of the 20th century, or beginning of the 20th century, by people like an American sociologist by the name of Kai Erickson. The sociology of deviance discusses the role of deviant individuals, deviant behaviors, and deviant institutions, deviant events within collective life. So deviance means something which is devious. It's not normative. It doesn't go the straight line. It digresses, right? So a deviant event can be a flood. A deviant event can be Hurricane Wilma. A deviant event can be, a deviant individual could be a drug addict, a criminal. A deviant event can be a war. And Durkheim asked the question, what do these kinds of events, how do they affect events, individuals, institutions? You know, a Hare Krishna center. How do these institutions influence the collective, the people, the group? And generally, particularly when we look at criminality, what we generally think is that people who are criminals, people who go against the norms of society, those people, you know, what do? We punish them. Why do we punish them? Because they're doing bad things. You know, lo tirtah, don't murder. So someone who's a murderer is killed or is put in jail. But what Durkheim said is that not only is deviance something which is punished because we have to maintain the law, but actually there is a functional value to deviance. That is, societies use deviant people, deviant events, deviant institutions in order to develop themselves. In order particularly to coalesce, to create a sense of unity, to create a sense of a collective. And I'm going to show you a quotation in a minute which is going to express exactly what I'm saying in a very, very short, in very terse and concise way, but I want to express it broadly first. That is that when people decide that a person who smokes marijuana is a deviant, well, that's trying to bring all the people who don't smoke marijuana closer together. That's a way of saying, who is the good person or the normative person? Or the person who does not smoke marijuana. The person who is not acting in a sexually inappropriate way. The person who does not steal. The person who does not possess radical political views, religious views. Essentially, what Durkheim and more so Erickson and others in the 60s argued, what they argued is that it's really hard, okay? And let's be adolescents for a second, okay? We all remember those days, right? It's so hard to figure out who are we? Who am I? You know, you look in the mirror, you get labels, right? You're an Orthodox Jew, you're an adolescent, you're a male, you're a female. There are all sorts of linguistic ways in which we try to define ourselves. It's very hard. Who am I? That's a hard thing to do. So what do groups do, individuals, and particularly groups do? They use the definition of the deviant as a tool for saying, who am I? Who am I? Who am I not? By saying, who am I not, essentially I am really trying to say, who am I? By defining the deviant, by saying that this person is a criminal, by saying that, oh, those communists, so during the Cold War, you guys heard about that? Yeah. During the Cold War, that was a way for people like Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson to, you know, talk about the evil, Reagan, talk about those evil communists. It was a way to bring together American society. So if you think about it, I don't want to give too many examples because I don't want to belabor things. Ezra's going to tell me when we're going over time, right? But what I want to establish here so far is that, based on these theories, that societies, it would be claimed, don't create deviants because they don't have a choice. Actually do it because they have, in other words, I guess they don't have a choice because it's a functional tool. That means that societies need deviants in order to create a sense of identity. We're going to hold off a little bit on the questions, but there'll be plenty of opportunity for discussions, questions. I just want to move along so we can establish, I always tell my students, you know, let's get like a mikan. Let's get like a lot of knowledge. And once we have that knowledge, let's attack, let's argue, let's fight it all about. But first let's establish our material and then we can debate. Okay. So getting back to our Jewish Robinson Crusoe, you thought I forgot about him, right? You know, never. He's still stuck on that island, right? What was he doing when he said, that shul, I would never step foot in that shul. So we think he's just being pejorative. We think he's just trying to, like, you know, put down, or we think it's just a stupid joke. But what I would say is that maybe what he was doing was trying to define himself. Maybe by, so to speak, virtually, because it's just a joke, but maybe what that joke is telling us is that this poor stranded guy, he's sitting there, and he's thinking, well, I got my shul. What does it mean? Who am I? You know? I have no people. I have no... Well, but if I create a deviant institution, and I can get a greater sense of who am I can... Well, that would be my deviant interpretation of a very silly joke. But I think it illustrates a little bit of this idea of how deviance is a functional tool. Okay, so now I would like to hand out some sheets. And a friend of mine told me the reason that you use PowerPoint is so that you control people's eyes. When you use PowerPoint, you can just put up your quote. You give out a sheet. It's got lots of people are smart. They get bored. They start reading along. Right. Not some people do that. Okay. So I said to him, you know, I don't like censorship. You guys can read as far as you want. Try to listen if you can. Ezra, do you mind passing them around? So we're going to look at some citations here and see if they can be helpful to us in our attempt to look at a subject that so far we have not talked about at all, which is Orthodox attitudes towards non-observant Jews. So far, what we've tried to do is establish some sort of methodological framework, some sort of foundation that we can use in terms of addressing a problem. And I hope that once these tools become familiar to us, we'll be speaking the same language. Essentially, what I was just doing in my terminology is language instruction, making sure we speak the same language. So let's just look at one citation which will essentially concretize what I've just suggested. If you look at Kai Erickson was a well-known scholar, a criminologist in the 1960s in America, and the group that he studied was Puritans in the 17th century. And I don't know how much you guys know about Puritans. You ladies and gentlemen know about Puritans. But Puritans, you know, they sort of, the Mayflower types, they hung out in Massachusetts, and they had very strict rules. about that govern their society. The thing about Puritans that most people do know from the 17th century is, you know about the Salem witch craze? You ever read the book The Crucible? Arthur Miller? Cool. Okay. So that was the third level, or the third in a series of attacks on deviance that took place over the course of the 17th century. What Erickson does is he looks at a historical group, and he looks at their behavior, and he sees this interesting thing. He sees that about every 20 or 30 years, the Puritans create a campaign against a group. First it was the Quakers, then it was the heretics, then it was the witches. About every 30 years. And what Erickson tries to look at is, what was the result of these attacks? And what Erickson claims, he's not the only one, there's someone named Nachman Ben Yehuda has done similar work about Europe. There's someone named R.I. Moore who's written also about medieval Europe in a book called The Persecuting Society, where he talks about lepers and Jews and homosexuals. And what these people are, what Erickson specifically says in the same light is that essentially each time that there was this campaign against a different deviant group, it was at a point in which there was what we call a boundary crisis. There was a sense that Puritan society was in flux, was in danger of losing its sense of cohesion, sense of being together. And that what happened was that the leaders of the society, religious and governmental leaders, essentially initiated, even consciously, these campaigns as a way to solidify community. I think for Jewish people, it's much easier actually to look at R.I. Moore because it explains a lot about things like the Crusades, things like the blood libel, the demonization of the Jews, or take a look at things like the plague in 1348-49, the Black Death. Okay, so Erickson takes this idea, and he then tries to draw more general conclusions about human society in general. He's taken a case study of the Puritans in the 18th century, looked at an historical development, and he's tried to learn something broader. And this is what he says. I'll read it. The deviant is a person whose activities have moved outside the margins of the group. And when the community calls him to account for that vagrancy, it is making a statement about the nature and placement of its boundaries. Who's in and who's out? In, out. It is declaring how much variability and diversity can be tolerated within the group before it begins to lose its distinctive shape, its unique identity. It's basically what I said already, right? But he says it nicely, right? Okay, so now, if we had just read it before, it would have been a little bit hard. Now that we extrapolated, we look at the quote and we see how he really hit the nail on the head. Erickson says another thing which is really interesting to me, and is really interesting about the Jewish case, which he says, is that it's very important that the Puritans had attacked different groups at different times. Because deviance is not it's dynamic. It's not something which is a constant. Meaning that at different periods in history, different groups can be deviant. That is, if we want to jump ahead to our subject, and we're going to go back, but it would be hard. There are people, but it would be hard to say that there is a significant group of people. I mean, a majority group, at least, of people in Klal Yisrael today that would say a person who is a public Sabbath desecrator is a deviant. They'd say he's non-observant. They'd say some people might, but 200 years ago, that wasn't the case. But if you ask people, for example, today, is it acceptable for a person to be avowedly Orthodox and avowedly homosexual? Well, there's starting to be debate about that too. But there, you'd find lots of people who would say, over the boundary, out of the consensus, over the line. So what I'm just suggesting here is how deviance is a dynamic thing. Defining the deviance The deviant is something which changes as society evolves and develops. And here we're looking at things not just sociologically already, we're looking at things historically. Okay, so now that we have this framework, let's talk about the Jews. And when we talk about the Jews, what we can say, and here I'm generalizing, and here Ezra was kind enough to bring my book, and you could, if you read the appendix there, you could get a really, I think, reasonably concise overview of how Rabbinic Judaism has addressed the notion of a person who is religiously deviant, and that's our subject here, someone who digresses from accepted Jewish practice, from the Talmud or even the Bible onwards. Yeah.
It's about this whole theory of deviance. From there, not, there's not only this point of that society needs to draw that to any deviance, there's also the fact that many forms of deviance are in and of themselves bad, such as criminals.
Okay, I agree with you completely, but the question would be, why do some societies persecute certain criminals and others don't? Why is it that in Amsterdam it's legal to smoke marijuana and in America it's illegal? What does that tell us? Is there something inherently bad about smoking marijuana? Or is there something about the Puritan origins, for example, of America which may affect how America perceives a certain behavior? Yes, absolutely. I'm sorry, your questions are important to me. I just want to make sure that we move along, and again, I'm here for as long as everyone wants. But you'll tell me even after if I'm going too long with my question. So far we're okay with me? Okay. So, taking a whole chapter, I would say basically the following. That, if you look at European Jewry in the medieval and late medieval times, let's say from the year 1000 till about the year 1650, 1700. Number one, we're talking about a predominantly halachic society, a traditional society in which Jews, using my Moriv Rabbi, Zatzal, or Zal, I don't know, Zatzal, but Zal, Jacob Katz's terminology. I was actually just talking about YU for a second. I was privileged to study with Jacob Katz, those of you who know him, who was one of the greatest historians of the 20th century, here in YU. After he retired from Hebrew University, he came and every 2 years to give a seminar in Bernard Revel Graduate School, and that was the source of a seminar paper that I wrote for him here eventually became it was expanded to my master's thesis. So YU gives you a lot of opportunities. And I'll tell you, he talked about people like me in his autobiography. He said, after I retired, I came to Yeshiva University and I found students who were well versed in rabbinic traditional texts. And my goal, my role was to show them how those texts could be looked at from a historical analytical perspective. So, he felt very blessed to have students who could read a piece of Gemara. Or to read Mefarshim. And we felt very blessed that here was a person who could help us expand in our perception of that. In any case, so Jacob Katz talks about pre-modern society as a traditional society, a society in which there is a consensus that the halakha is the basis for Jewish behavior, in which Jews are not citizens, but rather they have autonomy given to them by the non-Jewish society to run their internal affairs basically, and I'm generalizing, as they would like, and that people who deviate from the halakha are punished. Now, are they punished necessarily like the Torah says, Mechalel Shabbat Mot Yumat? Or are they even necessarily put in Cheirem to the point where they're completely excommunicated from society? Rarely. Why? Not because it's not in the books, not because people didn't believe in it, because the cherem, the dui, the whole excommunication system was so powerful that most people would not go that distance of moving beyond at least religious, halakhic observance in a public sphere. Why? Because there was no what Katz calls neutral society. There was no ability to say, I'm going to be what we call in Israel chiloni. I'm going to be a Jew, but I'm going to define my Judaism in a personal way, with an alternative ideology, or just for economic reasons, I'll choose to keep my store open on Shabbat. That possibly didn't exist in medieval Europe, in which you have a dominant Christian society, which said that Jews are governed by their internal rules. If you were put in Cherem, the only choice you had was to become Christian or Muslim in an Islamic land. So most Jews, even if they didn't really like keeping halakha, they wanted to be Jews. If you want to be a Jew, you gotta keep public halachic observance. So, what happens in modern society, and some of you I hope are familiar with this, is that with the breakdown of this autonomous Jewish framework, Jewish society loses this enforcement ability, coercive ability. The result being that, as Peter Berger says, modern society is a society of choice. Or as Charles Liebman, also a teacher of mine, that I was privileged to study with, would say, that traditional society is a society of taken for grantedness, whereas modern society is a society of choice, of infinitesimal possibilities. You can be any kind of Jew that you want. You know, you can be this and you can be that, right? You can be a Zionist, you can be a Reform or a Conservative or a Zionist or a Bagel Jew or a Beretta Jew or a Hatikva Jew or a Woody Allen Jew or, you know, any other, or an intellectual Jew, a professor Jew, or a poet Jew, or a postmodern Hare Krishna, Sikh, Indian, learning Kollel on Wednesday, and look for my karma on Thursday Jew. Any possibility exists because you have personal choice. There is no longer coercion. Israel, by the way, just an aside, is a fascinating microcosm, because Israel is what I would call a post-traditional society, but it's sort of neo-traditional, because in Israel, there is religious coercion regarding Ishut, regarding personal status, marriage, divorce, public laws of Shabbat, etc. And there is a Rabbanut. You have a Beit Din. So in Israel, actually, in the most modern, it's really a paradox, the most modern of Jewish societies that's ever been created, you actually have a reversion to a certain degree back to the framework that Jews lived in 300 years ago. In any case, what happens then in Europe in the late 18th century and in the 19th century is that we see the emergence of lots of different types of Jews who say, I'm Jewish, I'm not Christian, but I'm Jewish and my Judaism doesn't mean that I keep halakha and you can't do anything about it. Or maybe I wish I could keep halakha, but economic circumstances don't allow me to. And we can argue about whether they did or they didn't, but we know of many people who felt that was a decision to have to. Now, this is where we get into the core problem. In a traditional society, if a person was found doing business on Shabbat, or smoking a cigarette in public on Shabbat, honestly, what would happen to them, you know? Straight. What would they do? They'd say, no? They would start, they see your nidui, they'd say, you know, you have to do tshuva, you have to get maybe malchus, lashes, maybe they'd give them a fine, maybe they'd say you can't sit in your regular place in shul. Then, if he kept doing it, they say you can't get an aliyah. They say you won't do a shidduch with your child. We won't do business with you. You know, there was all process until we finally got to that Cherem where they said, you're out. And, usually that process worked to bring people back in again because they didn't want to be completely ostracized, as you said. Now, the only groups that can do that in a modern society are voluntary groups. If a person wants to be a Satmar Chassid, you can't be a Satmar Chassid. You might be able to be a Chabadnik and not keep Shabbos. But you can't be a Satmar Chassid and live in Williamsburg or live in, Kiryas Yoyal, certainly, or in, you can't be a Skvera Chassid and be Machal Shabbos for Hafrasya. But that's different than traditional society, that was voluntary. You can always leave and, you know, live in Riverdale, right? Or live in, west side of Manhattan, right? So, that's voluntary. Okay? In any case, the question becomes, what do we do? We are, and now I'm speaking not we, meaning me necessarily, now I'm talking about the leaders of Jewish society, who care about the halakha and care about tradition. What do we do? We have a set of laws which say, the chalal Shabbat mot yivar, a person who publicly desecrates Sabbath, should be capitally punished. We have laws that talk about a person who was a Sabbath desecrator or other types of religious deviants. You can't drink their wine. You can't trust them for a dude for testimony in court. You can't eat their food even if you know it was kosher because of who they are. All sorts of laws that ostracize religious deviants. But those laws were written, were authored in the time of, in the Torah, in the Talmud, in among the Rishonim, medieval commentaries, in a society where 99% of the people kept the laws. So that 1% of people who were thinking of becoming Christians and becoming apostates, well, that was a way to punish them. There were always deviants, but they were just that, deviants. And they tell us a lot about normative society. So what do we do? This is the question. How do people who want to maintain halakha as the normative representation of Jewish identity, of Jewish being, how do they deal with the modern deviant? The modern non-observant Jew. Now let me just tell you two more things, okay? Slowly but surely, as the 19th century progresses, those people are no longer deviants. Why are they no longer deviants? Because they've become the majority. And in my book, actually, I write about the concept of what I call the normativization of deviance. And actually, you'll see, if we get to it, that Rav David Tzvi Hoffman says just that. The absurd thing, you know? Here we are. Everyone's turning the page now, right? Here we are. And who are the deviants today? The Orthodox. Because, well, think about America. Who's a deviant in America? A Reformed Jew? An intermarried Jew? If 50% or 46% of Jews marry Gentile spouses and 10 to 20% of the Jews of America are Orthodox, then who's the deviant and who's the majority, the normative? So there's just for people who are Orthodox who want to feel like they're the normative, this scholar named Deborah Dashmore wrote a wonderful book called At Home in America, and she talks about minorities who have a self-consciousness of being a majority. And I think actually that's a very, very, very appropriate way of describing how Orthodox people actually look at themselves. But that's something we can move into later. Now just one word about a term that I'm sure everyone sitting here is familiar with, but I'm going to redefine it for some of you. And this is again based on the approach of Professor Katz. The question is, what does it mean? What does orthodoxy mean? What is an orthodox Jew? So, the way orthodoxy is generally explained when we're being educated in our homes and in our educational institutions, schools, camps, youth groups, etc., is that orthodoxy is Torah Mishnah. Orthodoxy is basically the exact replica of how Jews who kept the Torah have kept Torah since Moses' the revelation on Sinai. Now I won't argue with that from a theological perspective, and I'm not coming here to challenge that position theologically. But from a historical sociological perspective, I think everyone realizes that, well, that can't be true, because we have, 3,000 years, 3,280 years to sort of go under the bridge, right? And we have all sorts of historical things that happen. We have Hanukkah, and we have the Talmud, and we have the dispersion from Spain, and we have Sabbatian conflicts. I'm just sort of jumping around, but things happen, and people have to react, and people have to deal. And in the course of dealing, we evolve. Does the core remain? Orthodoxy would argue yes. But isn't it the exact same thing?
Well, it's a, we could, someone call it a mutation, some would call it a deviation, but it's certainly a transformation or a dynamic type of process, okay?
So, what is orthodoxy? Orthodoxy, I would say, is a modern movement that emerged in response to the emergence of alternative Jewish movements in the modern period. That is, when you have people who say to be a Jew is to be a Reformed Jew, to be a Jew is to be a historian, to be a Jew is to be a Zionist, well, what do those people who keep halakha do? They react. They don't just say, we're going to do the same thing we're doing until now, because if you're doing the same thing you're doing until now, well, first of all, you're probably not going to be able to deal with those people. For another reason, as soon as you have a choice, you're just not the same person, right? Like the kid who grew up in a home and did things his parents told him to, didn't have a choice. When he goes off to college and he has a choice, when he does the exact same, puts on the tefillin, says kiddush, learns Gemara, dances in a kol bachminah, whatever he does, it's not the same thing. Because until then he didn't have it taken for granted, like a traditional society. And once he is independent, she is independent, it's done out of choice. So orthodoxy is a choice. It's a modern movement. It's something emerged from a framework of choice. So what I want to think about now, with all that we have here, is how did orthodoxy come about? And what I'm going to argue, and I'm telling you in advance, and I'll tell you just a pedagogical thing. You know, some writers, teachers, lecturers, what they like to do is like leave people in suspense, you know, and like keep dragging you along. I don't want to. I want to tell you it up front, and I'll keep telling it to you. And by the end, hopefully, we'll be in a conversation. So I'm telling you right now that I want to argue here is that what by the Orthodox authorities trying to understand or to define or to punish or to react to the modern deviant, to the Jew in the 19th century who no longer keeps the Shabbos, what they were doing is just what Kai Erickson's Puritans were doing. What they were doing is not just punishing those people, but much more importantly, what they were trying to do is they were trying to say, who am I? Because orthodoxy is a new movement, which is trying to emerge and trying to figure out who are we. So there are ideologies, and Shimshon and Paul Hirsch can talk about Torah and Derech Eretz, and Hildesheimer can talk about it in a more intellectual way, and I don't want to get into all the other possibilities, but I think that one of the main ways that orthodoxy tries to figure out and say who it is by saying who it is. Thank you. So we're starting to talk the language, right? Right? Good. Okay. So now, I want to just throw in one more piece of sociology. And then we'll look at our sources. I have another argument that I want to make. And this is probably the essence, actually, of my ideas here and the book that I've written. My argument is that when Orthodox authorities dealt with this issue, what happened was some of them said, you know what? We have to continue to do things exactly the way the written text tells us to. And basically what they did was they said that what we have to decide is a person's behavior such that they are inside or out. Are they normative Jews still? Are they still normative Jews? Or are they deviant? Jews, not Jews, something in between. I would refer to those people using a nomenclature of Mary Douglas, the anthropologist, the English anthropologist, as enclavists. What they say is like a sect. They say is, we'll have our group. Our group will be as small or as large as it can be. But our group is going to be people who absolutely conform to a very clear identity and a clear mode of behavior. So everyone, just like in the Dead Sea sect or in you know, the Moody's for that matter, everyone who agrees with our theology and with our halakha, they're in. Everyone who's not is out. Those would be on places. But what I would argue is that the predominant attitude that emerged is actually a more interesting one, is what I would call a hierarchical mode, which basically says that if we're going to do that, basically we're writing out 90% of the Jews. Do you know that in 1850, or more than 15% of the Jews in Germany didn't keep Shabbat? 150 years ago. In 1920, only 20%. In 1920, 15-20, depends who you ask, is Marshors or Mordechai Breuer, 15 to 20%, okay? So, I think most people actually thought, if we just go and say, only people who conform to a very narrow set of rules and behaviors and ideas is part of Orthodoxy or part of Judaism, well, it's going to be a very, very small, narrow group. We'll lose all the Jews. But at the same time, these people thought to themselves, gee, if we just become pluralistic and we say anything goes, any Jew, no matter how they behave, no matter what they think, they're okay, well then why would our children want to be Orthodox? Educationally, right? If your parents say to you, all values are of equal weight, but we think that you should go to college. So you might not. Or we think you should be honest. Or we think you shouldn't steal. Well, then it becomes relative. And then it's not innate. And in postmodern society, that's very common. But most people believe that there are certain constants. There are certain absolute values. So if Orthodox believe, people believe that Torah and Mitzvot are absolute values, well, then if you start saying any Jew, no matter what they do, is a Jew and is just as just like everybody else, then what is the basis for promoting a certain approach? So what I think that most Orthodox leaders did was create what I would put in a hierarchical approach, which basically said, and we'll look at it a little later in the text, that there are lots of groups that are under one umbrella, but it's like a pyramid or a totem pole. There's top, there's next level, there's bottom. And you can all be inside, but maintain a distinction. And what they would basically say is that the Orthodox are on the top level, then other Jews are below. So rather than an in-out type of distinction, what you have is a top, middle, bottom. Hold on, not yet. So now I want to look at text, and I want you to tell me about these people. I want you to tell me if they're enclavists or hierarchists. How are we on time? Okay, well, we'll do it for that. Okay. So let's look at the Chatam Sofer. Some people would say the founder of Orthodoxy, a great Rosh Hashiva. He lived from 1806 till 1839 when he died in Pressburg, Bratislava, the capital today of Slovakia, and the Chatam Sofer, one of the greatest achronim, poskim, till this day. He was asked, what do we think about Reform Jews? I'm going to read it in English, but you have the Hebrew in front of you. So in English, he says the following. If we had the power over them, my opinion would be to separate them from our borders. We should not give our daughters to their sons, and to their sons. And their sons should not be accepted for our daughters, so as not to be drawn among them, after them. Their sect should be considered like those of Tzadok, Stukim, Vitus, Vitusim, Anan, Karaites, and Saul, Shaul, Paul of Tarsus, the founder of Christianity. They among themselves, and we among ourselves. All this appears correct according to the law, but not in practice, for without the permission of the king, our words are nullified. So Chatam Sofer says, really, if I could, I have a problem, because there are the secular Habsburg Empire is giving me problems with this, but basically, what we really should do is that, at least for Reformed Jews, he doesn't say this necessarily, he doesn't say it at all regarding public Sabbath desecrators, but give an example of Reformed Jews, he says,
performed this. We shouldn't marry them. We should have nothing to do with them. We should marry among our own. They should marry among their own. They should be looked at just like Christians, just like Karaites, just like, they're not all the same, but Dukim, basically, like how Judaism has written groups out of, deviant groups out of the norm for thousands of years. So tell me, would you say that the Chatam Sofer is a hierarchist or an enclave? Absolutely, he's an enclave. He is totally working on the level of in-out. In-out. Either you conform and you're with us, if you don't conform, you are against us, you are not a part of us. So now I want to look at someone who I think is a revolutionary. He's very famous, and the tshuva, the halachic response that we're going to look at, is one of the most famous ones that were written about this issue of how to look at a deviant Jew. It's written in 1861 by someone named Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger, known in Talmudic circles as the Aruch Laner. He wrote a tshuva, a book of responsa, which is called Binyan Tziyon HaChadashot. And Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger, who was the rabbi for most of life in a place called Altona, which is on the outskirts of Hamburg, in northwestern Germany. So he was asked about, he said, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, it's actually brought down the Beis Yosef in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah, that a person who desecrates the Sabbath renders wine forbidden. That is, we all know that the Talmud already says in the tractate Avodah Zarah that it is forbidden to drink wine of libation, Yain Nesach, and it was extended not only to wine of libation, but actually to Stam Yinam, meaning wine which was used by Gentiles not only for idolatry, but also wine which was used for basic usage. And the Gemara says there that the reason is because of chatnut, because to prevent intermarriage. It's there in the Talmud. But what it says in the Rishonim, and Beit Yosef brings in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah, the great medieval ethicist and commentator, is that this applies as well to Mechalei Shabbat Parasya, the public Sabbath desecrators. That it is forbidden to drink wine that has been touched by public Sabbath desecrators. Now, if I were to historicize, which that's not my goal here, is to analyze medieval, but if I were for a second, I could say that's because that was a way to prevent people from, they would assume that a person who was Mechalel Shabbat Parasya in the time of Rabbeinu Yonah was probably on the verge of becoming a Christian, of apostatizing. So that, they were sort of associated. Whatever it is, the Shulchan Aruch brings us down. So therefore, Rabbi Shmaryahu Zuckerman, who was the Mechutzen, he was from White Russia, a place called Mogilev. He was the Mechutzen. His daughter was married to Ben Sion Ettlinger, the son of Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. He sends a question to his esteemed Mechutzen. He says, you know, I never drink the wine of Mechalei Shabbat Parasya. I was wondering, you live in Germany, you got your society there. What do you do about that? What do you think about that? So let's take a look at this very famous tshuva, which is considered the source for the basic approach of orthodoxy towards non-observant Jews. And I want to show you how most people read this source. And b'mechilat kvodam, with great respect, I want to suggest an alternative reading, which I think is a little bit more nuanced and helpful to us. So what does Jacob Ettlinger say? He says, you know, I totally agree that the poskim say it's forbidden to drink the wine of Mechal Shabbat Parasya, to drink the wine of the public Sabbath desecrator. The question is, well, how do we apply this? And he says the following. This is 1861 in Altona. It was published by his son in 1878. And by the way, that's a very interesting thing. So if you look actually at the tshuva itself, it says there's a koteret. It's chaf. Gimel 23 in the Binyan Tziyon HaChadashot, which was published only posthumously. Rabbi Ettlinger died in 1871. His son, who's the son-in-law of Shmaryahu Zuckerman, he writes on top, Sakim la'alacha v'lo l'makseh. Decisions that are halachic but are not to be followed in practice. So many actually scholars have said, you see, this is just a theoretical formulation. So I'll even tell you at the outset, some very good scholars have said that. If you read the son's introduction to that volume where he explains how he edited it. He says, you know, I found these letters, some among my father, some among my father-in-law, okay? And I included them here, and, you know, I think after that, he might not have wanted people to base themselves on this. So I wrote Tzachim HaHalah Maaseh, but it's not like my father wrote that, okay? So his father wrote it as a psak. His son decided to present it as not practical. So it's interesting to think about how his father-in-law may have given him that letter and suggested maybe this one should not be used in practice. What's more interesting is that almost all the halachas, poskim, who quote this had no problem saying that this is lamasa. Okay, so they ignore totally what, except for the Munkacha Rav Shapira in his Minchat al-Azhar, he said, thank God, he knew, thank God his son wrote that little title, because otherwise people might follow this and it would be terrible because they'd be so lenient. Interesting how people look at these things. So he says, however, as to the sinners of Israel of our time, I do not know how to consider them, for because of the multitude of our sins, the sore has spread widely to such an extent that for most of them the desecration of the Sabbath has become like a permissible act. There are those among them who offer Sabbath prayers and sanctify the day through kiddush and wine, and then violate the Sabbath both regarding biblical and rabbinical prohibitions. The Sabbath desecrator is considered an apostate only because by denying the Sabbath, he denies the creation of the Creator, but this man acknowledges them by his prayer and kiddush. He says, you know, the guys who aren't King Shabbos today, they're just not like the ones that the poskim were talking about. We have a problem because I know lots of people who work until 6 o'clock at night in the winter when Shabbos starts at 4:30, and then they come home and they make kiddush. And the Gemara says, why is the Mechalel Shabbat considered like an idolater? Because they declare through their actions that they don't accept Maaseh Bereishit. They don't accept creation, because we celebrate creation through the Shabbat, the seventh day God rests and we rest, in the Tatzil day. So when we don't do that, we are essentially saying we don't accept the Torah's version of creation. So he says, well, what about a person who works on Shabbos, but comes home Friday night and gets the family together and says, he's declaring his belief in creation. So what are you going to do? You're going to say this person is a heretic? I have a problem. He says, it's not only those people. Moreover, what about the children who didn't get an education? And this is the term that many of us are familiar with if we keep reading B. And certainly the sons who arise in their places who neither know nor have heard of Sabbath ordinances are similar to Sadducees, Sukkim, who act according to the ways of their parents, and they are like an infant taken captive among idolaters. Ketinok shenishba ben ha'akum. And it is possible that the Sadducees too, who were not used to being among Israel and did not know the basic principles of the religion, do not act brazenly against the sages, were not considered intentional sinners. Mezidim. What does he say? Basing himself essentially on Maimonides' psak in Hilchot Mamrim, chapter 3, Halacha 3, where he says that the children of the Karaites shall be looked at in a beneficent way because they were taught Halacha from their parents who were Karaites. He says, similarly, these people are like the Gemara in the seventh parak of Shabbat, Klal Gadol. It says, people who don't know what Shabbat is can't be punished because they desecrate the Shabbat. If you're a tinok shnishpa, if you're a baby, you've been, the Holocaust, right? Babies were taken to a convent. They were brought up by nuns. If that kid grew up as a Christian, would you come and say that that child should be punished for not keeping Shabbat? You'd say, they're a tinok shnishpa. Rabbi Etliger says a big chiddush. He says a great original idea. What's he say? He says that a Jew who is brought up in a non-observant home is not responsible for their behavior because they don't know what Shabbat is. They haven't been educated to know what Shabbat means. And just like the Karaite son, or just like the actual baby who's been kidnapped, these people are not responsible, should not be punished, and therefore we can drink their wine, right? And therefore, we can drink the wine. Now, I want you to know that almost everyone who has ever, in a scholarly or a halachic framework, who has looked at this tshuva, has stopped here. He said, you see, Rabbi, you know, the sociologists and the historians, they say, you see what Rabbi Etlinger did? You think only the reform and the conservative changed halacha?
Look what he did. He changed halacha. He came and he redefined the Mechalel Shabbat for us. He says, it doesn't matter what you do, it's your intention. It doesn't matter whether you actually lit the fire on Shabbat, you know? What matters is, did you know what you were doing?
And based on that, you can basically, essentially, you can completely erase the concept of Mechalel Shabbat. It doesn't exist anymore. Right? So, they'll say, you know, he opened the Pandora's box to essentially the creation of a pluralistic modern society where there are no gradations whatsoever based on religious behavior. But the Mesilat Kodam, with great respect to these many people, they didn't, I think, do two things, which at least not only as learners but as scholars, I think it's very important to do. And that's, well, as learners, you should read all the texts. You should read to the end. You should read all the other texts written by the same person on the same idea. As scholars, you should also learn who the person is and what he did in his lifetime and how he behaved and how he spent his life and what was his own behavior vis-a-vis people like that in his own actions. And I'm not going to go into all the examples of the Troya Tzion Vechter, the newspaper that Rabbi Ettinger edited, or the Orthodox newspaper that he edited, or to many other decisions that he produced, but we'll just look within the text itself. Based on this pluralistic approach, we'd expect that the maskana, the conclusion of this tshuva, would be as following. Therefore, even though it's very sad that no one knows what Shabbos anymore is anymore, they just don't know. And therefore what? And therefore we can drink the wine of our brethren, our fellow brother and sister Jews. They are not brother. They are not other. They are brother, right? Once upon a time they were other, but they are brother. But that's not what they do. That's not what Ettinger does, what Rav Yaakov Ettinger does. Look at C. Therefore, conclusion, in my humble opinion. One who acts strictly and considers wine touched by these evildoers to be plain, forbidden wine, stam yenon, a blessing shall come to him. Well, if there's no problem with these people and their wine, why should the blessing come to him? Two, yet all, I put in the numbers, yet also the lenient ones have on what to depend. You know, but it's a problem, we live among other Jews, and it's, you know, it's not so simple. So those people who want to be made killed, not so good, but I'm giving you a heter. But is this a heter, is this a lenient position that I think is ideal? Absolutely not! I'll let you get away with it, because there is a way of explaining, but who is the proper Jew? Who is behaving according to the ideals of the Torah? Those who continue to refuse to drink the wine of a salvator. That's kind of like it was with Rav Shmar Maryahu Sukerman. Even Rabbi Ettinger said there are some Jews who should still not drink their wine. And I think he's talking about their wine. That's Reform rabbis who grew up in observant homes. Yet also lean, three, unless it becomes clear to us that he knows the Sabbath laws, he's a Talmud Chacham, and dares to desecrate the Sabbath in front of 10 Israelites at one time, not so easy. For this is surely a complete apostate, and wine touched by him is forbidden. So what I'm arguing here is that he does bring a very revolutionary concept which allows for leniency, but he does not erase the boundaries. What Rabbi Ettinger does is he moves from an enclavist traditional position to a modern hierarchical position, which creates greater openness, but essentially enshrines these divisions from top down. The Orthodox Jews, the ultimate approach is, don't drink the wine. Lower level, you don't have a choice. It's a gradation. Now let's go back to Mary Douglas. Turn the page, please. Hierarchy is essentially based on grading. So it must tolerate the idea of a recognized bottom level and make provision for it. Enclavists have reasons to avoid grading their members altogether. Their habit is outcasting rather than downgrading. Their exclusions all work on the outer boundary, the difference between belonging and not belonging. What does Rabbi Ettinger say? He says, I want everyone to belong. I want everyone to be a part of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people. But I've got a problem. And I understand this problem. If I erase the boundaries totally, then how am I going to get up in front of my kila and say keep Shabbos? How am I going to educate people to say that the true way is the way of the Torah? So Rabbi Ettinger's response is what I would claim a hierarchical response. Did he know Mary does this? Of course not. But what did I do as a scholar? What I did was I read these texts, and at a certain point, I started to think about what was going on here, and then I looked at certain sociological tools, and I saw that they helped me to understand these texts in, I think, a more, hold on, in, I think, a more, deep, or more a way that elucidates the text in a broader manner. You're being very patient, and I appreciate it tremendously, but just allow me, because it's hard, you know? Everyone's been very, very patient, and if you'll allow me another minute, then you'll have your opportunity. Okay. So, there are more sources we can read, and we could go on, but I want to give you the opportunity to respond, and I know there are people who are very eager to respond, and that's wonderful, and that's what I want here. I want feedback, and I want you to agree with me. I want to hear your own reading of things. But the major thesis, I think, hopefully, is clear. That what I believe is that orthodoxy, as a modern movement, has certainly transformed itself significantly from traditionalist pre-modern Judaism, and in regard to non-observant Jews. In pre-modern Judaism, the Christian, or the borderline Jew, was the deviant who helped define the majority of Jews as being normative. In modern society, the non-observant Jew becomes the designated other, the designated deviant. However, even when boundary definition is maintained, it is not thrown out, but it's used in a different way. Orthodoxy does not take a pluralistic position that everything is legitimate. What orthodoxy does is it creates an alternative method for dividing between itself and other Jews by creating a hierarchical framework. Now, I want to conclude with something which is not academic. But I believe that once a person, as an academic, has demonstrated something in a rigorous manner, that they are permitted to express something which is more personally engaged. As long as people can come and check the footnotes to see that they're not just subjectively reading into a text. So I've suggested a certain reading, and now I want to suggest something which is a little bit broader in focus. What I'd like to suggest is that Jacob Ettinger was a revolutionary. Some people didn't like what he said because they thought it was disingenuous. They said, call me a Machal Shabbat, don't drink my wine, but don't call me a Tinoch. Amos Oz writes about Rav Kook, the same thing. He says, it's so degrading. You're so nice to us. You call us babies. I'm not a baby. I don't keep Shabbat because I don't want to keep Shabbat. You don't like it, you know? But don't degrade me by telling me I don't have the intelligence or the emotional ability. It's something that we have to think about, okay? But in Jacob Ettinger's day, it was very revolutionary and very sympathetic to come up with this idea, and it showed a great deal of Ahavat Yisrael. What I would argue, and I can't go into it now, is that I think maybe we are in need of creative minds who are committed to Ahavat, and it's a great challenge, but who can come up with new formulations which can appropriately address today's reality. And I think today's reality and the relationship between Jews who are observant and non-observant is not the same reality that Jacob Ettinger spoke in, but we are still conducting ourselves with a type of and he would call it kiknasut, a sense of aboveness,
according to orthodoxy,
which stems from those battles of the mid-19th century, but we're in a, some will say a post-denominational, or a transitional phase, and I think at this point, I don't have answers, and at this point, I don't have the new formulation, but I think that if we want to maintain a sense of Klal Yisrael in today's reality, then hopefully people will begin to think in new and creative forms. Could you sit down, please?
Sure.
Did you have a question?
I have another question.
Okay, why don't we start? Okay, what I do when I do public lectures is I like to have a lot of people comment, because otherwise what happens is people tend to feel that it's just a one-way conversation. So let me start with one point. I'd love to hear your main point, your most important point, and then hopefully other people, I'll invite other people to respond.
Okay, first of all,
one point.
Well, you said that Rav Eslinger was not taking any sort of exclusionary approach. I would have to disagree. This last point of his, where he mentioned a Meir Panim, there he is taking in not only hierarchical, but actually he's excluding them.
You're making a wonderful point. And I agree that Rabbi Eslinger, did you want me to repeat the question?
Yeah.
Oh, what he said was, what about that third category? What about the bottom group? The group where he says, with regard to them, those people who know halakha, and I sort of glossed over it, those people, even them, regarding them, even today, I would say can't drink their wine. Right? That's the conclusion on the first page. He says, why are you telling me that he's being hierarchical? He's being enclavist, just like the Chatam Sofer.
I'm saying he's being a myth of hierarchy. He's being enclavist, but with the in-enclavist
So I would say the following. I think that by the way that he articulates things, it's a wonderful question, by the way that he articulates things, what he is saying is that this is the essential approach, but there is that exceptional case of somebody who I, based on my reading of Rabbi Eslinger, is someone who is, you know, a symbol in society of deviance. I would say that if we're talking about the mid-19th century, we're talking about most of the Reform rabbis who grew up in observant homes, learned in traditional yeshivas. They didn't have smicha, there were no Reform places yet, so they had smicha from Orthodox rabbis. And then, often in university, often through their reading, assimilated alternative ways of understanding halakha and Jewish life. And what he's saying is that here, I am not tolerant. And yes, I am willing to be exclusionist. But I don't think that the main point of I don't think that the main point of his response was to talk about them. The main point was to talk about people like those who go to shul, come home and make kiddush after they work on Shabbat, or their children who have not been educated in Shabbat. And this was just, if you look at the text, a side point. Okay, hold on. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, when Rabbi Eslinger says, Hashash Shabbat Rosh Hashanah, do you think he's saying that? Do you think that the Orthodox community, or at least him and some of the leaders, were taking responsibility for what was going on? They really felt that there was that was the rampant non-observance was their fault.
It's a wonderful question. It's something that I think that we have to be careful about. You know, doing sort of cycle history a little bit. I think that the term Balatino Rabim has multiple interpretations. It could be Nava. It could be because of our sins. Is it because of our sins because we were bad teachers and we weren't dynamic and we weren't like Shiv Sharma Prabhupada here says in the introduction to the Anointed Brifa, the 19 letters, he says there are two groups of rabbis in that day. This is written in 1836. He says there are those rabbis who are taking those what do you call those big hammers, you know, the breaking the walls down, those reform, He said, and there are those rabbis who are sitting inside the building as the walls fall down on them. And I want to essentially be a third type, which is someone who creates a dynamic, and energizing type of ideology. But he would argue, because the rabbis didn't know how to talk to the people, that's why they became non-Torah. But I think that, I'm not sure that that's what Eppinger had in mind.
Although, Hirsch, got a smith from Eppinger. So,
go ahead. What's your name?
Thank you for having me so patient. But I was wondering, if you view it as hierarchical, I don't see how that even flows and that it justifies.
Sorry, I guess you said something. You know, I have to tell you now. I learned in Shivat Haratzion in Gushen. There's a famous joke about how there were five people sitting around at late at night, you know, after long nights there, like 2 a.m, and they were talking about whether God is perfect. And they were talking about it, and one said, "Oh, of course God's perfect, you know." And suddenly, you know, he didn't read Mark Shapiro's book. But and thanks very much. Another book. And another one said, "Well, God's not perfect. What about the Holocaust? I don't know." Okay. And as he said that, all the other people, you know, one or two of them started moving away. And they said, "Well," and he said, "you know, we're having discussion. Why are you moving away from me?" He said, "Well, if God's not perfect, I don't want to be standing next to you when you get stripped down by lightning." So you just reminded me of that, but you know, not God's perfect.
I
won't tell you who that person was because that'll give away all.
It might be like a lower form of Judaism, like you say, but that still justifies it as a form of legitimate, valid Judaism, you know? Or am I not getting the point?
I think that your question is wonderful because you're forcing me to be more defined and specific. And maybe towards the end, as I wanted to give a chance for discussion, don't be sorry, Hatha. You're doing the most wonderful service. And, you know, that's how things really get to the point, the question and answer. What he said was, you know, even if you say there's a higher level and a lower level and a lower level, but once you include them all within the call, aren't you essentially giving them legitimacy? So, I guess my answer would be, is that yes and no. You're giving them, I'll call it, identity legitimacy without giving them theological legitimacy. What you're saying is, essentially, you are creating that sort of a bifurcation of, you know, that's a dirty word in some circles here today, but a bifurcation in what does it mean to be a Jew? Whereas once upon a time, a Jew was an absolute synthesis of both theological and ethnic or, you know, sort of collective identity. What Rabbi Eppinger essentially is saying is that there is one not only predominant, but there's one exclusive theological identity, that's the Orthodox approach. But that doesn't preclude the possibility of there being a broader ethnic sort of identity or peoplehood. And these people, just because they are not part of the Brahmin, from an Indian term, and I believe I didn't bring it here, but there's a very lovely book called Homo Hierarchicus, which was written by someone named Louis Dumont, who's a French anthropologist who spent a lot of time in India, and he actually extrapolated some of these ideas in a very lovely way regarding the whole Indian caste system, where you have these Brahmins who actually are interesting. They will eat the food and drink the wine of the lower levels, but they still maintain their sense of being an upper level. But in any case, I think that would be how I would describe that. Okay? Thanks. Go ahead. What's your name?
You mentioned before that the very reactionary from the modern movement, And also, it became like a modern, there's a new thing of actors. And the forms of theism,
also new.
They're also new, then they include the death of the not being new.
Well, Reform, you learn about Reform, you know that Reform, some people claim that the Orthodox forced them not to reveal Reform, early Reform, like in the second decade of the 19th century, they actually, well, okay, by the 1840s they were non-halal. Certainly Einhorn, very good.
Yeah. So then would you say that the true is most rabbinic and Pharisaic and more halakhic, most halakhic is good for the Judaism than the conservative Judaism, where it's not reactionary and it's also
I think that I wouldn't say that, for sure. I would say that it's not by chance that as Reform became more outspokenly non-legal, antinomian, essentially, in its accepted approach, the debates between Orthodox and Reform dissipated, except over power, and the debates between conservative and Orthodox raged, at least in America, for example, throughout the 20th century because it's much more liminal. There's the sense of where are the boundaries until today between some people who would call themselves left-wing Orthodox and some people who would call themselves right-wing conservative. I mean, I'm friends with everybody. You know, David Ellison from HUC is a very good friend of mine, and Jack Wertheimer from JPS is a very good friend of mine, and I consider myself a student of Rav Parnas, who taught here, who is a very Haredi person. But my friend Jack Wertheimer, if you read his articles lately, some people would call him right-wing Orthodox. He's a halachic student. He's Torah exposed. I don't know what he thinks about Torah and Shemayim. But regarding, you know, basic issues of halakhic conduct, he's very, very close to a lot of, you know, he might be swordfish, I don't know. But I'm not coming to make a theological statement. I think that, that I would not say conservative is the main, how I say, approach. I would say that it is much more complicated from a theological level, not from a sociological level, because sociologically, the fact that today, most Orthodox Jews in America keep Shabbos and most conservative Jews don't. So it's just easy to just make that split. But from a theological perspective, if you look at conservative attitudes towards halakha and Orthodox attitudes towards halakha, it is more difficult to distinguish. The distinction that would be made, which is an important one, it essentially comes down to what we call in legal theory de facto and de jure. Do you come and say, like conservative Judaism says, that halakha is dynamic, it changes, and therefore we have the power through what they call the folk. That's what Zaharia Franklin calls the folk, the people. When the people feel that there's a need to do something, the leaders can read the people and go ahead and change. Whereas orthodoxy works in a de jure, in a de facto way, which is like, there's a court case, you know, and in the course of a court case, there'll be an opinion. And the judge makes that opinion, it's not the constitution. But if you read that opinion, you'll see that that opinion set a precedent, and then over the course of years, it set a dynamic, which led to some very significant change. Some people will say that's just semantics, but it seems to me that Judaism, even in a pre-modern way, always worked in a de facto manner in terms of the dynamism, and the de jure way, which conservatism has adopted essentially since the Sanhedrin, I don't know, or since Talmud, or here and there we have cases like Rabbeinu Gershom Meor HaGola, who was de jure in the way that he made changes, but generally speaking, traditional and Orthodox Judaism has taken a de facto approach. Is that helpful? Okay. It's a loaded question, but okay. Manak.
If the end goal of the contemporary Jewish life is to be involved in, inclusive and welcoming as many people as possible and acknowledging as many people as possible, your own social or theological level, let's say social level, then I just don't understand how this comes. you know, it's kind of, you know, don't think of me as Tzimishpa. He's not exactly in the game that he's coming from. You know, currently Halakha says we're allowed to drink from wine that are non-religious Jew because, you know, they're just Tzimishpa. So we're trying to be as welcoming as possible. And, you know, Halakha is kind of bending over backwards to welcome as many people. And I was just saying, I don't want to be known as Tzimishpa.
Think of it this way.
But the ramifications are that.
Think of it this way. If Satmar Chassid said, Fadler, you're a religious Zionist? Okay. Neva grew up in a home where they taught him about Zionism. They told him that was a part of, you know, and he believed Rob Cook, and he read the Salvation and stuff, and Tina Tzimishpa. What can you do? He was given a bad education, you know. Would you prefer that, or would you prefer to say, Butler, that ideologue of religious Zionism, he's destroying the Jewish people, Yom HaSamos instead of Yom HaSmaos, and you'd say, well, he's being really nasty to me, but at least he recognizes that I have a legitimate ideology, rather than thinking I'm just stupid, or just immature, or just inane. So, if you think about it, I think that the best way to look at these issues is to try to step into people's shoes and see how we would feel if one did the same thing. So, that's just a little bit.
I'm actually in the sociology class right now, and I'm learning about
your
kind.
Where?
Where?
Yeah.
In relation to what?
No, which? Yeah.
So, Durkheim talks about religion and suicide. He connects the two, and he says that the more religious you are, the less suicide there is. And so, isn't like deviance in a way good in saying who we aren't, like comparing yourself to the rest, like having comparisons and saying we're not like those people, or like we're not like the not religious people, and like not saying that we're better, but like that. Obviously, aren't we like withholding a better society? I mean, like even Durkheim said that he brings in Judaism and Christianity, and like then like the people who like the atheists, and he said that Jewish people have less suicide, like a clear difference. You know?
It's interesting, you know, that was the extent of his Jewish identity, was his opinion on that. But you know, that's an interesting thing. I think that Durkheim. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I didn't try to put a value on deviance definition. What I tried to do was explain it. It's functional. In other words, it's part of human nature. The question is that if that function, like you said, results in positive product, great. The question is, what's the fallout? Okay? So Rabbi Etzinger felt that there was fallout by taking an extremely enclavist position. At the other hand, he agreed with Durkheim. You need a little deviance there. So what did he do? He created a different construction. I am questioning whether today that type of coalescence, is positive. But I agree with you that sociologically, or from at least a Durkheimian understanding of human nature, that just seems to be the way people have done things for years and years and years. On that note, I want to thank you so much for your attention, and I want to wish all of you luck.